How does it feel to be a problem? Dr. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois asked this question in his classic 1903 text, The Souls of Black Folk. Du Bois, as many of you will know, was the first Black PhD from Harvard University and went on to spend his career and most of the 20th century as the foremost American scholar. At the March on Washington, where this speech that Pastor Maria read, they announced on August 28, 1963, that at 95 years old, Dr. Du Bois had passed away the day before. Du Bois died miles away in Accra, Ghana, after giving up on the American project. He was tired of being a problem. So he found his own Wakanda. How does it feel to be a problem? Was centered squarely in the midst of the public demonstration. Du Bois' entire intellectual project was concerned with this notion of the Negro problem. Then that was the way the entire society referred to Black folks, so we'll hear it again now over and over again. Later in The Souls of Black Folks, Du Bois says that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, the relation of darker races to the lighter races. How does it feel to be a problem? Du Bois asked for nearly 100 years, and as Martin Luther King Jr. mounted the lectern turned podium at the Lincoln Memorial that day, addressing the Negro problem was the chief purpose of the speech. He brilliantly harkened back to 1863 when President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation as a great beacon and a great hope for millions of enslaved Black folks. But he goes on to say, but 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. 100 years later, Black folks are still a problem in America. And because we are a problem, Dr. King said, we came to Washington to dramatize what it means to be a problem in the land you helped build. What it means to be a problem in the land you came to on slave ships named after Mary and Peter and John the Baptist. To dramatize what it means to be a problem by people who fled persecution only to establish a system of total persecution here on this side. King urged the audience that they were protesting the all too long problem of racial injustice and oppression. See, before we can even begin to get into our text, we must deal with the reality of what Dr. King and the other organizers of the March on Washington, including and especially Bayard Rustin, who was an openly gay Black man in the 60s, we're studying Dr. King's sermon, and I believe we are looking into the I Have a Dream speech because there his radical yet relevant theology is hidden in the plain sight of the much venerated but less often understood dream speech. Short of being just a dreamer, he is an American prophet confronting, combating, and corralling against and challenging a problem as old as America. Martin goes on in the speech to say, we believe that America has given us a bad check. Marked insufficient funds, yet we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vault of opportunity in this nation. We have come here because we want what you owe us, America, what you promised us. And in this moment, I would argue that Dr. King is embodying what I call the inherited problem. See, on the one hand, Dr. King speaks passionately for the disinherited blacks who have languished in the corners of America. And on the other hand, he appeals to the promise and the hope of America shared by these same oppressed black folks who, despite their present circumstances, believe that America will ultimately do what is right. This problem, one in which we are problems in America and experience the problems in America and yet still hope that America can be problemless for our sake, and the sake of the whole nation, is a problem that applies specifically to black folks, but has implications for the whole society, for all of us who live here. In a sense, then, it is a problem that we all inherit by virtue of living in America. Put differently, it is the original sin of America, that all other sins and all other attempts at redemption must be understood through. It is the lens with which to understand America. It's a problem with historical, political, and of course, theological implications, but because y'all came to church on Sunday, we'll talk theology. In the theological sense, we would say, this problem is to at once recognize the depth of evil in a particular situation and still believe in the possibility that even the vilest situations can be redeemable. The theology actually undergirds the history and the politics of it all. In short, and in a general sense, black folks have been restrained in their hostility to America because of their faith in God. And there's something that we ought to learn from that. That even when people do bad things to us, we don't have to invoke the harshest measures. What would public policy look like if we took that seriously? What would presidential elections look like if we took that seriously? Black folks have been restrained in their hostility to America because of their faith in God and their ultimate hope in the redemption of America. It is this faith that many of us still carry, and it is this faith that connects us to our present oppression in this land often. It is a faith that many of us have inherited. It is a faith that we trace back to our foremothers and forefathers, but it's also a faith that we trace back to the words of Jesus. Right here in the Gospel of Matthew that Christian read for us in the Sermon on the Mount or in Luke's Sermon on the Plain, he says to his disciples, "You have heard it said that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil doer. If anyone strikes you on your right cheek, then turn the other cheek also." He also says that you have also heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemies. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. This text, Pastor Sally, is a problem, right? It doesn't speak to the revolutionary in me or the rebellious in me, right? This text is a problem, and this text has been used as a problem to quell the anger of legitimately angry people. I remember mere moments after the terrorist attack at Emmanuel AME Church, reporters shoved microphones in the faces of the families of the victims and asked them, "Do you forgive the killer? The body's not even cold yet." Without giving them time to grieve, they forced Jesus' words and ideas on the people. And so over and over, I've heard this text, and this message makes me angry. I must confess that I hate the violence that this text invokes and how it mandates forgiveness seemingly regardless of the circumstance. The more I wrestle with this text, the more I realize I hate it. Do not resist an evil doer. Turn the other cheek. Pray for those who persecute you. I'm ready to walk away from the religion of Jesus on account of this text. You hear these words, and Jesus seems like just a utopian dreamer, too distant from the realities of our world to offer any insight into how we ought to live. Maybe, Jesus, you are mostly God and not that much man. For if you were man, you would understand power and abuse and oppression. If you were one of us, Jesus, you would understand how the wicked prosper, how injustice reigns. You would know how Rome treats us, Jesus, how they march into our cities and take our children and confiscate our money. Jesus, if you were one of us, you would never utter the words to us to love our enemies, for enemies kill people and enemies brutalize and enemies feed Christians to lions and enemies burn down the temple and enemies displace and dislocate and destroy and deport enemies, enslave, and they strap God's beloved children to the belly of slave ships and make them travel thousands of miles away to labor under harsh conditions of the southern sun with little to eat and barely anything to wear, and they strip them of their dignity and their humanity, and enemies are responsible for the deplorable conditions of this world, Jesus. Enemies write budgets that raise taxes on the poor. Enemies send dreamers back home. Enemies are xenophobic and homophobic and want to give power back to police to renew the war on drugs. Enemies are responsible for the ghetto. Jesus, if you knew what enemies did, how could you tell us to love our enemies? Jesus, looking at us, says, I have enemies too. I have been persecuted and I will be persecuted, and I march on to the cross. I understand what it means to have enemies. I took part of a rebellion. Dr. Aubrey Hendricks tells us that Jesus was born in a ghetto that rebelled against Rome, that Jesus is Mary's baby, and you remember her song. Jesus is a revolutionary. Jesus comes from a radically oppressed household in a radically oppressed town in a radically oppressed colony of a radically oppressive empire. And Jesus says, I say this not to mock you or to taunt you, for I know the depths of your pain. And I even know that evil should be resisted. Freedom ought to be fought for. Justice should roll down like waters. And this text isn't theological cover to stay quiet about abuse, violence, oppression, exploitation, or any other evils. That's not what Jesus is doing here. We must resist those things and speak up against them and create a world in which justice flourishes. But what Jesus is asking us to do, the move he's making theologically is a bit more subtle. He's saying that as a victim of violence and oppression himself, and as someone who has come to liberate the world, as someone who has come to transform and transfigure the world, that we won't get our true liberation, our true freedom, our true healing, if we simply do what oppressors do. If you simply repay evil with evil and hate with hate. Theologically, if we want to establish a just society, Jesus says, if we want to deal adequately with sin and evil, pain and injustice, wickedness and violence, malintent, then we have to walk a different path. Dr. King puts it this way in his own sermon on this text entitled On Loving Enemies. He says, Jesus, while he wants us to destroy evil systems, is always worried about the individuals trapped in there. He says, love is a refusal to defeat individuals. Evil systems, sure, but not individuals, because they might be redeemed and transformed. But just because Dr. King says it or Jesus says it, it may not be good enough for us, right? But perhaps we should take them more seriously, because they had enemies. They lived where we And yet, still in all of that, they could still stand and say, you should love those who hate you. See, this aspect of the inherited theological problem is indeed vexing. It's vexing because it pushes us deeper into the unknown. Jesus doesn't tell us how or when enemies will be transformed. He doesn't tell us how much time to give them or how much effort to spend on them or how many conversations or how many times to say, I forgive you. He doesn't tell us how to do that. He simply leaves that to us. He gives us the command and walks away and leaves the work of deciding that for us. But in that, it's freeing too, because there's an opportunity for us to mess up. Sometimes people have pushed our patience too much. But the possibility of redemption, of transformation, is always there. And just another thing as I think about this text. The more I hear it, the more I'm pushed to wonder who Jesus' primary audience was in the first place. Now, I know who he's talking to on the mountain, but I also know that Jesus was shrewd, right? Jesus was shrewd, and he knew his people, and his people probably were already living this commandment. For they had to do so for their survival as oppressed people who had just rebelled and just had to deal with the reality of Rome tormenting their families, as people who had to bury their dead and eulogize their revolutionary sons and daughter. I'm sure they knew the cost of violence. I think the crowds knew that oppression just carried on, and they knew what transformation would and could look like. Pastor Maria, I think that Jesus had a different crowd in mind. Jesus was shrewd, and he knew that the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin and the high priests and the Roman soldiers always knew his whereabouts. They always knew what he was talking about. I believe that he was talking to them. I believe that the strongest form of this word was for Rome and the temple and for the oppressors who continue to walk in the same religious and intellectual tradition as Jesus, but yet refuse to love on the people that they live with, that work for them, and that were subjugated by them. I think Jesus was trying to say to them, you know, you created your own problems. You don't want the people to rise up, but you whip them and you crucify them. You extort them and you accept bribes. And I want you to know that you have built this empire on their backs. But if you learn to practice a little bit of love and forgiveness and mercy, you might have the true peace you think you've already established. Jesus was talking to his enemies. And friends, I think Jesus is talking to us. I think Jesus speaks to America today and pushes us to deal with this vexing but inherited problem. And I think Jesus asked the whole country to practice this type of love. By virtue of those of us who call ourselves Christians, and right now it's still 80% of 300 million people, so I'm going to assume that all of us are Christian in that 80%. Jesus says then that if we are all Christians, then we ought to practice this kind of love. And Jesus challenges us and says, why is it that only such a few actually do it? And the ones who do it are the ones who languish under pain and oppression. See, one of the problems with the inherited problems is that black folks and other marginalized people, with all their grievances against America, with all their pain and oppression, all the violence they have experienced struggling under the weight of oppression, they have discovered the power in, yes, resisting, but also the existential power in not hating their enemies. They have discovered the power in praying for those who persecute them. They have discovered the power in giving themselves over to deep, unrequited, genuine love. Martin King runs to the middle of the public squares to utter these words of Jesus to America, and to especially white Christian America, that we must take Jesus more seriously and learn from the religious practice of black Christians who, though they could have waged war against this nation, decided not to. I'm almost done, y'all. It's unacceptable that for far too long, it feels like in this country, only black and brown folks have read this part of scripture literally. And I think the time has come for people in power and folks on the sideline, folks in the middle, for white Christian America, through our public policies, through our public narratives, through our theology, through our faith workshops, through everything that we do to construct the moral imagination of this society, to take these words seriously too. I believe deeply in my heart and in my soul that if America, but especially white America, could see the necessity of loving your enemies, our world might actually be transformed. It might actually be more just. Our lives may actually be more whole. We might actually be able to live with compassion and abundance. We might actually be able to live in the beloved community. We might actually be able to forgive people and relinquish our need to kill people, and relinquish our need to harm people and to extort people and to make people take drug tests just to be on welfare, just to have a life in this country. We might relinquish all of that and actually see each other as brothers and sisters. I really do believe this. I believe that we need a new theology. A theology rooted in liberation that confronts and challenges and dismantles injustice while also taking up this inherited problem of how do we live together in the kingdom of God. I also believe we have this theology already. It's in the words and the life and the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth and in the invocation of our modern day prophet, Martin. I just pray we all take it a bit more seriously.